Hi, Dan. Nope, it's not Dan again. Still not Dan.
Nope. Eventually, if you keep doing that, it's going to happen.
Eventually, it'll be Dan. It's John Moltz, yeah. Dan's compatriot on the rebound. Hi, John.
I got drafted.
Yeah, the rebound. I was thinking about that. You guys have been doing that. I mean, you guys started that about the same time I started Upgrade, which is basically Dan and I left our jobs.
Yep.
And started podcasts.
One way or the other.
And that's
right.
Dan,
yeah,
and I,
yeah. Because I was just on Clockwise,
way,
and I was just on Clockwise.
Right.
And it was episode 463, and we just passed 400. Is that right? 400 for the rebound. Yeah.
Yeah, Upgrade's at 419, right? It's just in that in that ballpark.
Mm-hmm.
Clockwise is funny because we started that at IDG, and so theoretically we would have had to sort of remake it as a new show that was similar but with the serial numbers filed off. And I asked for permission to take it, and they said, "Yeah, you can take it. We're not going to make anything of it." And then I heard later that a higher up than the high up executive, I like went up two levels. And that person, that you know, president of whatever, said yes. Mm-hmm. I heard that the person above him at the very top discovered that we were doing this and was furious.
Oh, really?
It made me so happy. Made me so happy because that guy was an empty suit who did nothing but cut budgets and was a jerk. And the guy who gave permission, I had a good relationship with, and he knew they weren't going to do anything with it. But the guy above him, as is exactly what you'd expect, was like, mm-hmm. "Well, it doesn't matter if we own it. I don't care. Don't give it away. Even if it has no value to us. Let's just be jerks."
Sure, right? Yeah,
because that was
you always hold on to what's yours
because business.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Lex and I have been kind of Lex and I, and then also Guy and I have been kind of surprised that we can actually fill the time. And I think in both shows we're actually going over, and what we discovered is that Dan is the one that keeps us on track.
He's a moderating force.
Yep.
Dan is a force for good. That's what we're saying. He's a force for good, and we miss him. Except he keeps popping up. In
definitely,
our
the audio quality is the audio quality has gone down since he left.
You know. That's
but that's my editing.
It is always a challenge when your person. I just had this happen with an incomparable thing where somebody's like, "Well, how do I stream live?" And I'm like, "Oh boy, okay." It's like we're doing a D&D thing, and Dan, James, and Jason aren't there. How do we do it?
Yeah.
And I'm like, "Oh no, your three people who know how to do the technical thing are not there. What do you do?" I walked them through it, but it is funny. I would imagine most of the Six Colors podcast listeners are the people that the people around them go to, like, for the thing where it's like, well, you're the person who does this stuff. You're the person who mm-hmm. knows about computers. You're the one who's going to help, whether it's your friends or your family or even at work. I realized I was going to have that role from my college newspaper. I ended up as the editor-in-chief of my college newspaper, and yet, who was the person who climbed around and ran cable so that the mm-hmm. computer network mm-hmm. worked? It was me. It was me.
Yeah.
I was the guy who was like, why isn't it printing? Talk to Jason. Okay.
Why do you think that you, and I started it like that too. Why do you think that it was you as opposed to somebody else?
We had the network because I ran the network because I was like a computer guy who was like, why is it that I have to take a disk over to the computer that has the printer mm-hmm. in order to print? And like, have you not read the back pages of Mac User Magazine where they have networking equipment? And they're like, well, no. And I was like, oh, okay, that's why I'm here, as I have read the back pages of Mac User Magazine. And I mean, I don't know. There's a predilection to that. It's funny. So my dad, who passed away, you know, almost 10 years ago now, geez. He was very good with his hands. He was like a mechanical kind of guy. And he grew up in the Depression, and so like he was always like using wire hangers to fix stuff and things like that. But also he had like a shop, and he ended up being an orthodontist in part because I really believe because of the technical nature of it that it was wires and applying force over time, and it was very much a mechanical kind of thing. And I've always thought that my interest in computer stuff is sort of the born in the 70s version of my dad's mm-hmm. sort of predilection for, you know, machinery and you know, nuts and bolts and stuff like that. And it came out expressed in me in this completely different way, which is hooking up TVs and running cables and fixing, debugging software and stuff like that. But I think it's the same predilection. And I think a lot of computer nerds share that sort of thing.
Yeah. I also think it's not being afraid. and sometimes that means damaging things, for sure.
I was going to say,
because I definitely did that at one of my first jobs.
The curiosity overrides the fear is what I find. It's still fear, still there, but you're like, but what if I could do this?
But I worked at the government. I worked at the government for a while early on, and I would, you know, like something would happen with the computers, and I would just like, I would start to do stuff, and they would, I mean,
no.
The government, they would get super mad. I mean, that would be like, you could be hauled in front of people. Like, you are not supposed to do that.
No, there's a guy. Well, that government, the impression I get is with government, especially, and there's other industries that are like this. It's like, no. You do your job, not the other. Mm-hmm. I was actually talking to my wife about this because she's a librarian, right? And she works at a small library that's a city library. It's not part of a larger system. And it's a small staff and then some part-time people. And they are a team. And like if she needs, she does some book ordering and she does some story times and she works on the desk and she does some weeding of old books. And she's doing all these different jobs. And she's got friends who are in like the San Francisco Public Library system or the Berkeley Public Library system or the Oakland Public Library system. Mm-hmm. And at those places, it's like, no. You do your job. And if there's something else in the library that needs to be done and it's not your job, guess what? Don't do it.
Right.
Because they get very angry because it's like we have demarcated jobs. And and I get it. Like there are a lot of organizations like that. Sometimes it's a union thing too, where it's like, no. We pay somebody to do that. It's their job to do that. Well, that's for me, that became, especially working in computer journalism, right? I've always said no worse job in the world than being the IT manager who supports computer journalists, because you know, it was always a battle, right? Because we always were wanting to do things that they didn't want us to do, and so there was a battle. But I felt for them. I mean, there were ones that I didn't feel for so much because they were jerks, but I felt for them in general because it was an unwinnable situation, which is, first off, are we going to install that software? Yeah, whatever it is that you don't want us to install? Too bad. We're going to install it because it's our jobs. Are we going to upgrade things? Yeah, we are. Are we going to just go buy hardware and bring it in and use it and run it into the network? It's like, yeah. And I did have IT people tell me things like, no, this is your production system and you should have a second computer next to it that you use for all your testing. And we're like, second computer, are you kidding? So I felt for them, but it did become a running battle of like, no, you shouldn't, you know, don't set up a Slack, don't set up a campfire, a base camp, don't set up, like, don't install this software, don't use this hardware. And it's just like, guys, you are trying to manage the unmanageable because it's our job to do this stuff. And I felt bad.
I worked at a financial services company for a long time, and I was in the accounting department, but I did IT stuff in the accounting department. And so that was kind of cool because it was somewhat similar because they would let me do stuff that without going through the IT department. But then, you know, as the company got bigger, that changed a lot. And then we moved. So it used to be in Tacoma here. It was a small family. Well, it wasn't that small, but it was family run. And then it got bought by a big company, and eventually they moved us up to Seattle and put us in, you know, like open office space. And so I was in the accounting department in an open office space, and like right there was like the design, you know, the marketing design group, and they were all running Macs, and they were all completely out of control of, like, because the IT department was like, okay, they have Macs, they can do whatever they want. They're like, we're not taking responsibility for them. So first of all, they're like, you know, in eye shot, because now I can see them because we're in this giant room together, and I see them and they're all running these Macs, and I'm mad about that. And then I also like noticed them, you know, like under the desks doing all this stuff, and I was like, God, dang it, I really want to be over there. And so eventually I just left.
It's good call.
Yeah.
Good call. You know, it's summer. One of the challenges of being the people who do podcasts every week is that there comes August, and in the Apple world, at least, sort of like nothing is happening, like betas.
But rumors, betas. Jason, there are rumors.
There are rumors. I mean, I am starting to have that moment of you talk about your fear. It is that moment of like, oh my God, the iPhone event is going to be how soon? and I have to do how much work that has been nebulously this summer and now is like, bang, we you know, you got a month to do your iOS, or at least macOS and iPadOS theoretically are now going to come out in October. So I got some time there. But it is, nothing makes me itchier than that idea of wait a second, what? The iPhone event is soon? Like maybe in the next month? Really? Oh no, summer is coming to an end. Yeah. I don't like it.
There are kids going back to school.
I know. And you know, other kids doing their college orientations, but not going That's back. Right. My kids don't start school until the end of September, but you know, but
yeah,
there's a lot between now and then too.
Yep.
That's it's funny too, because we try to plan stuff for early September, and I'm like, you know, at some point you're not going to see me. At some point the iPhone thing happens, and and there's reviews, and then there's going to be an October event, and there's going to be reviews, and it's like, I'll see you at Christmas. Yeah.
So you are a mini user, an iPhone mini user?
I am. That came up on Clockwise today. Yeah. I have the mini. I bought the blue mini 13, and I love it.
Yeah, I think that's going to be my upgrade this year. I had the mini 12. Yeah. And I think I'm going to go for the mini 13.
Presumably they'll cut the price, so it'll be pretty affordable.
And I was looking at this thing about the prices today, because, you know, with no mini, that means the average price of phones is going to go up. And also apparently they might start charging more for the Pro as well. And the Pro Max.
At least those are the rumors.
Ming-Chi Kuo, as we discussed on the previous show, he's someone to pay attention to.
Yeah, I believe him. I love the Mini, and I know that, you know, most people don't, but I used iPhone 10, I was just kind of there with everybody else, and the iPhone 10 was larger than the previous phones, but it was like, all right, but it's nice, and it's OLED, and it's great. And then that Mini came out, and I held it in my hand, and I was like, oh yeah. I remember this. And the truth is, I know that there are lots of people, and the pandemic has changed this some, but I know there are lots of people for whom their phone really is their life. My daughter, everything is on her phone. She has a laptop and she does some things with it, but for school and things like that. But her phone is her life. And I'm not that person, right? Like my iPad, I spend way more time on my iPad and my Mac than I do on my phone. And that partially is because I don't leave the house. So why do I even need a phone, quite frankly? Mm-hmm. So as a result, I look at this thing that fits in my pocket and doesn't bulge out my pockets and is light.
Yeah.
And like the display, I know it doesn't fit as much information on it, but it's like, it's plenty. Typing on it, I think actually is a little bit less accurate than on a larger phone. I really do. I think that the small target does make a little bit of a difference, but really I opted out. I could have bought a Pro, right, and gotten the great camera and all that. And I took a step off because I just thought smaller. I just like it. And I don't need that extra space. Is that the same thought you have?
It really is. And I do try, if I have to type something that I know is going to be of any length, I will go to my Mac and do it for sure. I don't want to bother. And maybe that would be different if I had a larger phone, but it's okay. Because like you said, I'm not going anywhere because I'm usually just here. So that's another reason. But my mom sent me, she was, you know, cleaning some old stuff out, and she had a bunch of old devices, and she sent me a couple of old iPad minis and her two old phones, one of which was a 6S. And then the other was a 3GS. And if you can get something from, you know, a woman who has lightly used devices, because when she had that phone in particular, she would use it and then turn it off and put it back in the box. And so it is in pretty pristine shape. And it was really cool to hold that in my hand. And that form factor felt just great. I mean, I was longing for that period where that was the right size of phone. And even that tiny size seemed really cool and really good to me.
Yeah, well, I'm gonna miss it. I hope it returns sometime. Somebody asked me.
Well, that's what I'm. That's yeah. what I mean, I gotta think that eventually they will try and scoop up stragglers like me, and just release those little phones every now and again, which is okay. I mean, I've managed to survive so far.
I had a Wishcast that I did basically, and the idea there that Wishcast is not a new kind of podcast, by the way. I should be clear. It's just I was thinking I had a dream that was like, oh, they could do this, but I also thought I'm only thinking this because I want it to happen, right? Which is, who says that the Mini has to come out every year, right? Like, who's to say? Like, they could do it every other year or every third year, and it would probably be fine. And I started to think, well, maybe that could be even a strategy is, you know, you do the 13 Mini and the 14 Max and the 15 Mini and the 16 Max, and maybe you just alternate them. But what's going to happen is that 15 Max is going to... the Maxes are going to sell incredibly well, and they're going to be like, oh, forget it. We're never doing a Mini again. But again, like, yeah, it could be an SE, or they could just do a Mini every so often. I've become a real believer in the idea that the iPhone is a complex product line. It is half of Apple's revenue, right? Like, they can afford to make a bunch of different models for different people. And like, it's okay. Because what you want to do is have everybody buy an iPhone and be happy with their iPhone. And it, like, is it really a problem to have five models or six models instead of two? Like, they already have, right, they've gone to four models.
It doesn't seem like it for them. I mean,
it was one, then it was two, now it's four. It's like, I like it. I like it. Keep it up, because there are some of us out here who want that, you know, throw us a bone every few years. I wonder, like, I could sit out this year. Next year, it's going to be tough for me to be like, I'm just going to hang on to my old, you know, two generations back phone. I may have to make a move, and I'll be sad about it, but, you know.
That, at some point, I mean, honestly, I got the SE2 when it came out. I mean, I had the SE1, and then I upgraded the SE2 before the Mini came out, and had that for like 6 months or something like that. And that's an okay phone. I'm all right. I'm okay with that. It's not my favorite. But I love the fact that it's cheaper. but it's still a good phone.
It is. Yeah.
I mean, I would think eventually they will get tired of that form factor too. That will seem even dated for the cheap phone. So I sometimes wonder if that will be the, you know, like if they'll move the Mini into that slot.
I would take another Mini in 2 or 3 years that's styled exactly like this one. That's fine. Right. Like, even if they've got the cooler
with updated internals. Yeah,
I would be fine with that. I mean, then again, you know, show me the phone of the era. And if I think it's amazing and it's got the camera that's going to blow me away and all that, maybe I'll be sad and I'll be like, all right, OK, you got me. But I like to believe that Apple is going to be a little broader with its iPhone targets, because, again, how many Mac models are there? And that's 10% of their business, right? Like, you could have a lot of, and how many iPads are there? There are a lot of iPads now too. So more iPhones is fine. It's fine.
Yeah.
It's fine with me.
Yeah.
Oh, is there anything else going on? I always ask Dan this, and you know, the problem is,
was I supposed to, I've already explained that I can't do what Dan does.
No, there's,
I end up going long about nothing.
It's a tough one. I wrote a link post the other day about that interview with Ben Stiller where they,
talk about how,
and this is not just Apple, but streaming in general, like they don't tell the people who make the shows the actual numbers. So apparently Apple shows Ben Stiller some charts and says, see, it's good. And he's like,
Are these we used to call them the Amazon charts, right? But they're also Apple charts now.
Bezos charts, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's the, they said it's not like ratings or box office numbers or anything like that. It's like graphs and charts that are relative. Like, yep.
Yeah.
And I get that it's a trade secret, sort of, but at the same time, it really bugs me because I accept that I want to know, right? Like, I want to be able to compare everything, and I get why you might not want to be able to, you know, have your stuff be compared to anybody else, especially if you're Apple or Amazon. You're playing a different game than they are. You're not, your business is not based on this. It's just additive. But if you're a creator, not only is there the ego boost of like, is anybody watching this? But which the Emmys can suffice for some of that, right? It's like, oh, but Emmy adulation, it's fine. But like, what about your next job? Like, how do you point at the show you did for the streamer where there's no data and say, Netflix told me it was good? It's like my mom says that I'm cool. and so it suppresses, I feel like it, you know, suppresses the value of the people creating hit shows. Like, why would I tell you that your show is a hit? It will just make you ask for more money. And so they just don't tell them. And that part really bugs me.
So I'm blanking on the name, the classic market researcher company that
Nielsen
used to do. Nielsen, yeah. They can't do streaming in the same way? I mean, they can't just survey people and find out?
There are. I think that is all still happening. And then there are places like, I do that podcast downstream with Julia Alexander, Parrot Research. They're doing like demand where they're focusing on like, they've got a panel and they ask them what shows they're interested in, right? And so they've got that mm-hmm. part of it. And then, yeah, there are market research companies like Nielsen that are doing like, we've got a panel and we watch them or we ask them. I think that maybe that's part of what's behind like Roku and stuff like that, having the ability to recognize what's on your screen, is that they're able to sell that data in terms of aggregating viewing data. And people say it's creepy, and it is kind of creepy, but I think in most cases the data is not used for anything other than things like aggregated who's watching X, because otherwise how do you know if the streamer doesn't tell you? But it's like, aha, but we're in TVs and we can see what's on that TV and log it. So some of that stuff goes on. I think the problem is that that nobody really ever had a huge confidence in it, but at least it was the only thing that was there. And now everybody knows they know, right? Everybody knows they know exactly, right?
Yeah.
The streamer knows. ABC never knew how many people...
As opposed to broadcast television when nobody had any idea.
Exactly. ABC never knew exactly how many people were watching The Love Boat. It was a lot of people. On a Saturday night. But
we had nothing else to do.
They never knew... So they just took Nielsen's word at it, and you could argue, and there are a lot of great stories out there. Original Star Trek, I love how the narrative is that nobody watched it and the fans had to rally. And then I read that book, which you might have read those too. These are the Voyages. It's the three books about the making of the original series.
I have not read those. No.
Oh, they're really good. That three book history. It's really eye opening. And one of the things that I learned in there is that the problem with Star Trek is that Star Trek existed in an era where they hadn't realized how important demographics were. And so Star Trek had among people in the key demographics, as we would think of it today, which is basically young people, 14 to 29 or something like that. Star Trek was the number one show. It was the number one show. But old people didn't like watching the space Spocks and whatever. They're like, blah, blah, blah. Yeah. Give me
Who
Green
are these
Acres.
Weirdos?
Yeah. I want to watch some Bonanza. And so... so they didn't get that, but it's not as if they weren't successful. It's just that the definition of success was different then. And I think about that too, that it's like, everybody's perception is different, and the value of something like a Nielsen survey is different. And the problem now is that like, we know that the numbers exist. Exactly. That we know how many people press the button and said, show me Severance. And we know how many were on episode one and how many got to episode six or eight or whatever, the last episode. We know the arc of that. And they can compare it to other shows. And like, we all of this is known, but none of it is shared.
Even how fast they're consuming it too.
Yeah.
Like, are they sitting down and just gobbling through it? Or, you can't do that with an Apple show that only gets released once a week. But
Julia and I
Netflix.
Talk a lot about the binge versus weekly release. Mm-hmm. And I love the weekly release because I'm an adult.
I do too.
I don't have 8 hours to binge a show. Like Sandman came out and it's like, great. I've watched one episode of Sandman and I loved
so
it.
So have I.
I'm going to keep watching it, but it's like, I'm not going to watch it all weekend. It's not going to happen.
The
stats will tell the tale though. Like, if you're Netflix or Apple or whatever and you look at the stats, you'll be like, oh, people really love to binge this, so maybe we'll release this as a binge, maybe not. Like, Apple's not going to do that, but Netflix might do that and say, no, this is a more bingeable show where I'm going to do it that way. But they literally know all of it, and they know when the word of mouth hits too. Like, nobody knows about Severance, and then week five everybody is starting at episode one for Severance because they're getting caught up because they've heard, like, they could see it all. And that's great, but there's no agreed upon, like, I do wonder sometimes if it's going to take like a union negotiation or something where there's actually a mandated data release in a standard format for viewing numbers for specific shows that everybody has to follow. Kind of like internet ads, remember, when or podcast ads even, where they're like, okay, we need a best practices here that everybody follows so that we're all using the same numbers. That would be nice. I don't know if it'll ever happen, but it sure would be nice.
That's new business for Lex.
Yeah. Oh, boy.
I would love to see
another house.
Sure. I would love to see the burn on Ted Lasso. Just like how, like, because I think it probably started out real slow. Because I remember watching it early on and not really being enthused about it. Like, I was just like, oh, it's an Apple show. I guess I should probably give it a try. And then was like, first episode, well, it was good. Second episode, it was really good. Third episode, oh my God.
Yeah.
This is amazing. And then trying to talk to people about it, and no one else had watched it at that point, like very few people. So I feel like that was a complete word of mouth thing, and it took a little while to get it going. And I would just love to see that chart.
Wouldn't it be fun? Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's part of this, too, is I would really like to have some sense of what the hits are and what the hits aren't and all that. Mm-hmm. And we don't know that. But boy, yeah, if it was my... If I was a director or producer or writer and or an agent, I suppose, for those people, I would be so mad about the, like, you got to take our word for it. It was big. Like, that's not, I mean, I get it, but boy, that's rough. That's rough to not be able to to say, look at what we did. That's why you need to pay us the big money.
Yeah. I mean, and I assume that Severance did very well. Right. Because I feel like it got really good word of mouth. But at the same time, it's a much tougher show to watch than like Ted Lasso, which is such a feel good show. And so Ted Lasso has a much broader appeal, whereas Severance, I think you kind of have to be. You have to be a certain kind of person.
Yeah.
As we were talking, like, you have to be the kind of person who doesn't want to work in a big corporation.
It's dark and
or does and hates it.
It's dark and weird and paranoid. And and I do love it. I think. I was thinking about, I mentioned the Emmy Awards and all of that. I was thinking about how there was an article with Rebecca Waddingham and Brett Goldstein. Yeah,
from Ted Lasso. I did this yesterday on the
trying to think of their real names. Brett Goldstein, films to be buried with. About Ted Lasso, where they said when they were making it, they just assumed no one would ever see it. It's like Apple. We don't even have Apple. And that was really, really in the early days, right? And Apple TV, by the time that Ted Lasso came out, they had done the morning show and stuff, and they'd started to gear up. But still, it was a real issue. And I think about Apple's quest for awards, and part of me thinks that it's ego about, like, look at us. We won a lot of awards. Tim Cook gets on the analyst call, and he's like, oh, yes, he gets awards. But the truth is, I think part of it is they want the awards for their negotiations
marketing
with talent.
And, yeah.
Okay, with the talent to say you will not be lost. Like, it becomes like, you know, your show might go to Netflix and be seen by a lot of people, but in the end, no one will talk about it because it's going to be released in one day and it's going to be over, you know, eclipsed by this other Netflix thing.
Yep.
Our shows, you know, there are some complaints about Apple's marketing, but the fact is, if you look at the awards, you're like, just being on Apple doesn't mean nobody's going to know about your show. We've had word of mouth hits. We've had a bunch of Emmy winners and a bunch of Emmy nominees. We won Best Picture. Like, you're not going to be lost on Apple. And I think that really is like bigger than the stats to say, you know, look, how about forget the stats. How about a statue? Let's see what I did there. So anyway, I should leave the comedy to you, but I feel like that's part of their thing too, is just saying, you know, this is proof that people care about what we release. And so you should feel okay about coming here, is that if we're getting nominated for and winning awards. So obviously people are finding this stuff.
Yeah. And I guess, I mean, it always seems like Netflix to me, and keeps canceling shows that people really like, but maybe they don't.
I mean, if
they have those numbers, they must know. Maybe just the people that I know really like that show.
I wonder about Netflix being too focused on the numbers. Like, they seem to be so proud of their analytics because they got all that data to begin with. It's like, oh my God, we know exactly, that they maybe get caught up in it a little bit And this is my worry about all the Warner Brothers Discovery talk about David Zaslav, the new CEO, who's a business guy, and he's cutting, mm-hmm. you know, cutting budgets and all of that. And like the challenge there is that it is a creative business, and it is a business, right? And people are like, oh yeah, but you know, right. all these creative people, but it's a business. And it's like, it is a business, but it is a creative business. At the end of the day, he needs to have creative executives like Casey Bloys at HBO, who's really great at this. But like, their company has to be a place where they make deals with people who are creative and feel like yeah. their thing that they're going to create is going to be in good hands. And I know that at the end of the day, it is a financial transaction. You pay them to do the work. But it's not just that. And if you reduce it to just the numbers or just the dollars, I don't think you're going to be a successful creative business, right? It has to. You yeah. have to have more understanding of those people and their mindset and what the show is and what the movie is and what they're trying to do. And that's, I think, when I was thinking about that in terms of Warner Brothers Discovery, but I think it goes for Netflix being too slavish sometimes to the numbers. It's not like yeah. it's not yeah. just about the number. I know the numbers matter. I'm not saying the numbers don't matter. I'm not saying money doesn't matter. I'm saying it doesn't. It isn't the only thing.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there are definitely some shows that don't necessarily take off that change the industry still.
Sure. Right?
And I mean, okay, that doesn't hit your bottom line necessarily, but it does also, I mean, first of all, it improves, improves things generally for everybody, and it gives you more room to do other things in the future.
Right.
So it makes you, you know, it improves your future business by opening up opportunities for different shows and retaining people's interest.
The worst management types that I ever worked with in my corporate job were the people who couldn't see the big picture.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what you're getting at there, which is, you know, Netflix might say, we're going to cancel this show because the stats don't work, or because it's not going to help us reduce churn, or it's not going to bring in new subscribers. And then you might look at it and say, yeah, but our subscribers love it. And people in the world talk about it. And that is not a zero benefit. Like, our subscribers love it, will reduce churn. And people talking about it out there does bring in new subscribers. And it makes our existing Netflix subscribers, who we don't have any way to measure their happiness with our service. Churn is mm-hmm. not necessarily a proxy, because I'll tell you, after they've raised their prices, I think a lot of Netflix subscribers have been unhappy with what's going on with Netflix, but they're not yet yeah. willing to cancel it, but they're unhappy, right?
Yep, absolutely. I mean, so, I when I got into watch Sandman, it hit me that, man, I don't think I've been in Netflix for quite some
yeah.
time. And
yeah.
I was ready to, I mean, if I did not live with two other people who, for whom it sounds like, when you say I'm thinking of like canceling Netflix for a while, it sounds like I'm, I don't think we should have running water for
yeah.
a while.
Yeah, for, to save some money on
you know,
that.
Not even that they're yeah. watching. I don't even think they're watching it very much either.
But it's inconceivable.
As far as I know, they're watching shows on other platforms, but it's like, it just seems, oh my God, we've had Netflix forever. How would we live right. without it for 3 months or whatever?
And maybe I'm being, you know, I'm being a touchy-feely hippie type person, which I find funny because I don't think of myself that way. But when I was in my corporate job, especially, I always felt like they looked at me like I might as well be barefoot. Like, you're like, oh, you're an editor or whatever.
It's like those charts, Jason. It's all relative.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. So,
it depends on who you're, it depends on who you're comparing yourself
it is,
to.
It is. So, you know, but there's this idea of like, you know, sometimes you just got to look and say, I'm happy that this show exists on our brand because it makes people happy, and we need that because that's how we're successful. And I know yeah. it can't just be that. It's like, oh, this show is bankrupting us. It's like, okay, well then don't mm-hmm. do it. But if, like, you gotta look at the big picture, and that's always. In my media days, there would always be the guy who would come in and say, hey, you know what we could do is the words that the editors write that are words that are popular with advertisers, we could sell those words and put ad links on the words and make a small amount of money incrementally yeah. over what we make mm-hmm. now. And I would have to have, and I had this fight a dozen times, which was, no, like, okay,
yeah.
no, I'm like, why not? It's more money for us. I'm like, okay, well, one, it's the editor's words, and you shouldn't sell the words of your journalists because the hyperlinks are chosen by them. But two, it degrades the entire website and it makes your users unhappy. And I know you love advertising, but if there's nobody reading the stories, there's nobody to see the ads. So I would have that fight and I would win it, right? I would be like, you are ruining the website, because the higher ups mostly saw the big picture of like, oh yeah, this is actually bad for our product, even if it makes us a little bit of money.
Right.
Also, they put those ads in the moment I left. Literally, the moment I left, they put those terrible ads in. I'm like, all right, well,
flip the switch.
It made me feel good that because I hated my job for that last couple of years that I was there, but it made me feel good that all those arguments I was having, which is one of the big reasons I hated my job, is that it was just endless meetings where I was trying to fight all of these ways that they were trying to make our website crappy. That in the end it did have an effect, because the moment I was out of there, they all the crappy stuff.
You were accomplishing something.
Popped in there.
Yeah.
We paid this guy a lot of money to yell at our dumb salespeople. That was his job. It's like, why would you even have that person? And they finally decided that was good. And that's when that they shouldn't have that person anymore. And that's when Upgrade and the Rebound started. So that's
I was thinking about that show C. Which I only watched a couple episodes of.
I watched the whole first season, and I thought it was okay.
Did you?
Yeah, I thought it was okay.
Yeah, I think, I mean, like, and I thought it was okay. I mean, it's unfortunate that it comes at a time when there are so many amazing shows, and I feel like I can barely keep up on the amazing shows that I can't have time to watch something that's just okay. But they tried something, right? You know, I mean, they tried to do something that was about accessibility in a particular way, and they spent a lot of time and money doing it, and it may not have worked so great, but at least they gave something new a shot.
Yeah, I like that. They spent a lot of money on it, apparently. It was one of the most expensive TV shows ever made, and the third season is coming out, and it's the final season, so it's one of those things where they're like, okay,
that was enough.
land this. That's actually a lesson that I think Netflix hasn't learned, and maybe they've got the numbers to support this, but I feel very strongly that if you're the owner of a show or the home of a show, that show has a much better lifespan if it has an ending, right? Than if it just gets canceled and doesn't have an ending. So you really should be motivated to get the show to a landing. So like with C, they're like, well, we don't really want C to go on, but we only paid for 2 years, so okay. Mm-hmm. You can have a third year, but you need to end it then. I think that's a reasonable thing to do, because then C will sit in the Apple library as a completed thing, and people will be like, oh, did you ever watch that C show? Yeah, I watched the end. It was pretty good. Yeah. You should watch it.
I mean, I think I have gone to you a few times over the years to like talk about a particular show, like Counterpoint, where I was, I think I asked you, I was like, does it, or Counterpart, where it was like, does it have some sort of an ending? And it does have some sort of an ending. I mean, they could have gone on, but it does have like a, and then this show recently, I don't even can't remember how this came up, but, The Lost Room, which was a pilot on, Sci-Fi. Hmm. And it was three long episodes though. And it's a show sort of a la Fringe. It's similar in certain ways, didn't get picked up, but the core story has, you know, the story of those three episodes has a bit of an arc to it that you can you can enjoy. And it was funny because we were talking about it on Rebound and mentioned it to Lex. And so Lex decided to start watching it. And whatever channel that he was watching it on, I think it's on Roku and some Amazon thing. I can't remember what the name of it is.
Freevee.
That one. I think he was watching it on Roku and it just stopped like midway through. Like they didn't have all the episodes queued up for some reason. And so he was like, well, I thought you said it. had a discernible story for these three episodes. Like, no, you didn't see the end. You keep looking because there's more episodes out there, and he managed to find them. So
that's good. Yeah. Well, John, thank you for taking the time to be here.
Sure.
And
I'll talk TV anytime.
Yeah, it's great on the Six Colors Podcast. Well, you know, we just have to do what we have to do with Dan.
That's
not
right.
Around.
Yeah.
Except around. That's the thing. If you notice, like, he's still in like Slack and Discord and stuff. He's just not doing podcasts. And I guess we're too.
I got an email notification saying somebody logged into the Rebound Twitter account from Somerville. Massachusetts.
It was probably Tony Sindelar.
What is Dan think he's doing? He's supposed to be on leave.
Oh, actually, I do know the story there, which is, and hopefully he'll tell this in a blog post at some point, which is that his iMac that totally died. What helps when you know the author of Super Duper, who is Dave Nanian, who has done all of the weird things about Macs booting and rebooting and all that, is that when your iMac is totally hosed and won't boot, you can call Dave and Dave will walk you through the process of unhosing it. And that's apparently what happened to Dan. Yeah. So I think Dan was probably like restoring and logging back into his accounts.
Yeah.
He told me this story and I was like, Dan, you should write that up. Oh, right. Dan, you should take notes and write it up when you come back.
It's always funny sending an email to Super Duper when something doesn't work right. Because I mean, he comes back with it and he's like, "Hey, John."
Yeah, I have that with
here's the answer.
Like Twitterific and BB Edit is like that, where I'm like, "Hi, I know who you are. Here's my bug. Here's a bug." And yet there's a BB Edit bug.
And he's always like, "Yeah, he's 10 steps ahead of me. He always knows exactly what it is and what the solution is."
Yeah. I also have it sometimes where I talk about something on a podcast and the developer emails me. And it's like, "I heard, I'm concerned about the thing that you said about on your podcast." I'm like, "I'm sorry.
I can't believe you didn't mention this."
Yeah, I can't believe it. That's outrageous. All right. We've had a couple of weird. I heard from somebody who was like, "Why are you posting this not on Friday morning?" And the answer is, I post it when we do it because it seems silly to hold it, and then things happen. And then you'll say, "Why didn't you talk about this?" And I'm like, "Because we recorded it on Wednesday." I'm also traveling because my son's got his college orientation. And then he's coming back with us because he doesn't actually leave for school for a month and a half. But next Friday, I should be back here ensconced for our next episode. And who will it be with? I don't know. But I'll figure it out. I don't need suggestions. I got a bunch of suggestions last week from people who are like, "Oh, I'll
Dave
do
Nanian.
It." And I was like, maybe so. Maybe that I should have my guest find the next guest. That would be a funny thing to do.
Oh,
John, your assignment is to tell Lex that he's on next. I don't know.
Okay.
All right. Thank you, John, for being here.
Thanks.
And thanks to everybody out there for listening. Bye, Dan, wherever you are.